So the parent-child relationship is a pretty common one. But the next is universal and far more nebulous. It's our relationship with death.
Absolutely. I think our relationship to death is rotten at its core.
This is Alua Arthur.
I think it's fear at the root. We fear the unknown, not knowing what happens after we die, not knowing why we're here, not knowing why we die, not knowing why life, why depression, why heartache. Often people fear the process of dying. They fear being in pain or being uncomfortable. We fear suffering. And I think also the fear of not being the center of the story anymore is very disquieting. It's uncomfortable. It makes us feel really small and powerless. And that's not nice to think about.
Alua is a death doula. She provides non-medical support for people at the end of their lives and for their friends and families, which can mean anything from counseling to legal advice. It's 100% not the kind of job that Alua can just mention to people casually.
Either they say they wish that they knew that we existed when somebody in their life died, their mother, father, brother, sister, somebody, or they start telling me about their ideas and theories about the afterlife because they think I might know somehow. Or most often it's duh. Like a birth doula? And I'm like, yes, but for the other side. And they say, oh, and I watch the eyes pop open.
Alua can give the impression that she's always been a death doula, that it's something she was called to early in life. But
that wasn't always the case. I came to this work by serendipity, by circumstance, but mostly by necessity.
Here's Alua Arthur on the TED stage.
A little over 10 years ago, I was practicing law at the Legal Aid Foundation of Los Angeles, and I grew depressed. Not like a, oh my God, I'm so depressed, but like for real depressed, like can't get out of bed depressed, can't shower depressed, can't find hope, can't find a smile, but can't really find joy type of depressed. I took a medical leave of absence where I went to Cuba, and I met a woman there, a fellow traveler on the bus who had uterine cancer. We spent the 14-hour bus ride talking about her life and also her death, and it was a highly illuminating conversation. I heard firsthand how hard it was for her to even be able to talk about her fears around mortality and her disease because people censored their own discomfort with mortality rather than make space for her. I took the invitation, however, to think about my mortality and looked at my life from the perspective of my death for the very first time, and it was grim. I did not like what I saw. I noticed then that I had to live life on my own terms because I was the only one who was going to have to contend with all the choices that I'd made at my death.
So you had what sounds like really a life-changing conversation with this woman. It made you think about your own mortality in a way that you had never before. And then something awful happened.
Not long after that bus trip, 6 months later, my brother-in-law was diagnosed with stage 4 Burkitt's lymphoma. Mm. But I also believed that he would get better because I couldn't imagine a world where he wouldn't. Mm. You know, it seemed impossible that Peter would die. He was young. He was otherwise healthy. He was a dad. He was one of my close friends. There's no way. He's my sister's husband. No way. Of course he's going to live. That's just how it goes. And then 4 months into his treatment, I do remember distinctly the moment that I found out that they weren't going to be able to cure him. Mm. So I moved out to New York where he and my sister and my niece were and supported him through the end of his life along with everybody else, his community that was there. And during that time is where I felt a strong need for the work that I currently do, but couldn't find anybody, couldn't identify a person who could do the job that I needed them to do.
So, but you learned a lot in terms of what people need during those tough months.
I did. Most importantly, I think I learned how isolating it is. Mm. And there weren't people that we could really talk to about what was happening. Professionally, at least, it was like, where do we lay all these cares down? Who can be there? Who can hold my grief and my anger and my frustration and all of my questions? How do we talk to my niece who's 4 about dying? Mm. You know, what are we supposed to say? How do I bring up that he needs to update his will or what he wants done with his body? or, you know, what's the right time to start talking to his parents about the fact that he doesn't want to be buried or might not want the Catholic burial that they want for him. You know what I mean?
So many questions. So how did you decide that that person that your family needed but couldn't find, how did you figure out that that could be you for other people, that you wanted to be a death doula?
Well, after his death, I went to an intro course on the work of a death midwife, is what it was called. Mm-hmm. And that was the first time I heard a term that felt like it could encompass what I was looking for. And I swear, I left the intro session crying and dancing and laughing and scared, just terrified, but being like, I think this might be something. And it was something. It is something.
The thing for you.
It's my something.
This is when Alua dove deep into death care. She took classes, read books, met professionals, and she quickly found that the image many people have of what happens when someone dies is just not true. For example, funerals.
I thought when somebody dies, they come to take the body away, and then the next time you see it, it's laying in a casket with its arms crossed at its chest.
The body has been embalmed, pumped full of preservatives.
And they look kind of gray and not at all like themselves, but that's supposed to be them.
Stories are shared. Religious texts are read.
There's a service that is often very stiff, and then they bury them, and then they put a headstone on it, and then that's it.
I mean, it's what we've seen in basically every movie or TV show.
Exactly. Turns out that's not it. You can keep bodies at home after somebody dies. They can be cared for at home. You can invite people over to the house. You can decorate caskets. You can wash bodies yourself. You can care for bodies in the way that feels best for you.
Alua, since she was a lawyer, also wanted answers to some of the more practical questions, like what do you do with someone's car after they've died?
Turns out it's an entire process that you don't want to do when you're not grieving, let alone when you are grieving. It's just such a pain in the butt.
She got to know people in death-adjacent fields, like estate planning attorneys, life insurance agents.
I met with some EMTs. I sat with hospice nurses. I took a job at a hospice.
But wait, this is well, way and beyond the initial course you took, right?
Yes.
Okay.
This is me just being hungry and nosy. And I wanted to get closer to the mystery and found that every step that I took opened up more mysteries. And that titillated me. That excited me.
In a minute, Alua Arthur shares how one client on the verge of death learned to enjoy the simplest pleasures of life. On the show today, Relationship Repair. I'm Anoush Zamarodi, and you're listening to the TED Radio Hour from NPR. We'll be right back. It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Anoush Zamarodi. On the show today, Relationship Repair. And we were just talking to death doula Alua Arthur about how we all need to mend our own relationship with the inevitable.
I sit deep in the trench with folks as they prepare for death. There's no fixing or saving anything because there's no fixing or saving grief or death. It just is. I meet people where they are at. My goal is to help them answer the question, what must I do to be at peace with myself so that I may live presently and die gracefully, holding both at the same time? I used to think dying people had it all figured out, though. I used to think that they'd lay there with their hands like this, because we all know this is like universal dying person pose. So they'd lay there with their hands like this, and there'd be a little glimmer in their eye. They'd be like, oh, yes, finally, it all makes sense. Turns out it's not like that at all. It doesn't look like that. Hollywood has lied to us. We know that already, right? Cinderella was unconscionable, but this is just flagrant. It's not like that at all. It's way too much work to be doing while you're dying. So it doesn't look like that. There's no secret. There's nothing magically you'll find out then. This is it. There's nothing to figure out. No big secret at all. Many of my clients also reach the end of their lives wishing that they had more time. But I'm always curious, more time for what? What else would they do with the time that they had? It's rarely to go see Machu Picchu, okay? I'll tell you that.
In your talk, you tell a story about a client who you feel kind of represents a lot of the struggles that you often see people facing. Do you mind sharing that now?
Yeah. This client, when she came to me, she had practically everything else checked off the list. She had her end-of-life plan complete. She just was looking for anything else that she needed to do. And what became clear was that she was still trying to figure out what her time on Earth had been for. She'd had a great career. She'd had children. A big thing that came up during the conversation was a bit of a judgment of herself that her children hadn't been the center of her life and that they weren't everything for her. She thought that her purpose somehow she'd been wrapped up in her kids, and for her it wasn't. And so that caused a lot of confusion. Mm-hmm. And she felt as a bit of an outsider to a lot of mothers that she knew. But when it came right down to it, she became clear that her purpose wasn't wrapped up in her children or her work at all, but the fact that she was alive, that she had a chance to be here for the time that she was here and to engage with food and other humans and laughter and sunshine, which was, I remember chatting about this with my therapist, who was like, I'll bet a lot of people don't ever say that they don't think that their kids are the purpose of their lives. Mm-hmm. And I thought, oh, that is so controversial.
Mm-hmm.
So juicy, so salacious. Mm-hmm. We can't say things like that.
Mm-hmm. Can't even think it.
Can't think it.
Mm.
But for many, I think it's the truth.
Mm.
And we deny it until we're laying on the deathbed and we're thinking, wow, did I wrap myself all up in something that was not true for me?
While she was healthy, it was about the next career milestone or what's happening with the kids next or the next trip. When she was sick, more of the same. Next doctor's appointment, next scan, next medication. It was always out there. She was always, always looking out there. But death was coming to remind her that she had no more out there. That it was always only right here, where there is nothing at all to do, but simply to be. We zoomed out on her life to look at what she enjoyed, to see where she placed value, because from there we can figure out where we place meaning. It was about the little things. Her hands in the soil, her garden, building a fire, reading books, and food. She loved to eat, but she had dieted most of her adult life. Does it sound at all familiar to anybody? Okay, if it does, this is for you, okay? If you take nothing away, hear this. You are going to die, so please eat the cake. Eat the cake. Order the dessert. Eat the French fries. Eat the brownies. Eat everything you want to. Just eat it, because you're going to die. One day, you won't be able to anymore. At this point in her disease process, chemotherapy had ravaged her taste buds, so she had to rely on her sense of smell to get pleasure out of eating. And she ate. She did it as much as she could because she knew she wouldn't be able to for much longer. She ate as much as cancer would allow. And when her body could no longer process food, we placed her favorite passion fruit souffle right on her lip. And she would lick it and smile. She lived more in the last 8 months or so of her life with the help of hospice than she had before. She was finally present at home in her body, delighting in the richness of the sensory experience we have by virtue of these fantastical bodies that we will die in. These bodies that we will die in.
Are you actually there with the person and the family when they die?
It depends on what the client wants for themselves. Sometimes they want somebody there. Sometimes the circle of support really needs somebody there. But at the baseline, I trust my clients in their innate capacity to die and the people that care for them in their capacity to care for their dying. And so I'm there when somebody requests it. But aside from that, I'll just sleep with a ringer on in case they need me. And most of the time, they just need a question answered, like, is this okay? Or heartbreakingly, one mother called once and asked if it was okay if she got into bed with her daughter, who I think was in her 40s, who was dying.
Mm.
And of course, the answer is yes. Hold her. You know, this is going to be the last time. Hold her. Hold her.
You know, I just hesitated when I asked you that question. I was going to say, how many people have you been with who have passed on? And then I was like, no, just say it. Say the word.
Yes.
Say
yes.
Died.
Yes, Manoush.
Oh. It's hard.
A plus. It's so hard.
Why?
So, I mean, they teach us not to.
It's a thing. You know? You live, you get born, and then you die.
Just like that.
Yeah.
In fact.
Yes.
It's a fact.
We've been on a bit of a quest in my family to reclaim the word. And then the other day, my daughter and I were talking about composting, and I just came out and said it. I was like, this is what I want you to do with my body when I die. And she looked so shocked at me. And I was like, am I like hurting her psychically? Is she going to be talking about her this moment with her therapist 20 years from now? Or am I just starting to open a conversation that we should all be having? And I'm still not sure. What do you think?
Mm-hmm. How old is she?
She's 13.
Okay. Well, I think that, well, first of all, A+ for your daughter for saying something.
Thank you.
No, I don't think that that's going to be a moment that she's going to have to talk about in therapy later, although I don't know your daughter's constitution. But I think that it's important. I think that when we hide how we feel about death and dying from children, it reinforces death phobia and it further pushes it into the closet. Mm. I'd suggest that you also spend some time talking to her generally about her thoughts about death and dying. Mm. Have grandparents died? Did we make space for grief? Who in her life has died? You know, let's open the conversation to make space for death overall.
I mean, this sounds like something all of us have to do. Let's say you're not quite ready to commit to taking a course, or you're not at the point where you need to hire someone like you, or you can't hire someone like you. What can we do?
There's so much. There's so much we can do. Building a relationship with death is a lifelong process. We just created a new practice where every day you get a question, which is based on a lot of the questions that I notice I use when people are dying as I support them in reconciling their lives, their legacies, their loves, their relationship to their bodies and themselves and the people in their lives, etc. It's like, when do you feel most at home in your body?
Oh.
Because that's something we want to cultivate as people are dying, because dying is a process of coming home into the body. Mm. My favorite question, what must I do to be at peace with myself so that I may live presently and die gracefully? Questions like, your most delightful experience of the senses, to see if we can cultivate more of that. We talk about aging a bit, but we're not hitting anybody over the head with death. Like, let's take it easy. Let's ease into the warm bath and see what that feels like and learn a lot about themselves in the process.
So if we had to sum up one idea for folks listening about how to change their relationship to death, it sounds like you would say, think about it. Allow yourself to think about it.
And you're safe to think about it. Mm. And if you need some additional support, holler at a death doula.
That's Alua Arthur. She's a death doula and founder of Going With Grace, a company that provides end-of-life planning, training, and support. You can see her full talk at TED.com.